I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. We are reliving our road trip show from this past August, and we'll move now from the Wye Mill to the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. It's a massive 28,000-acre oasis located about 12 miles south of Cambridge. It's known as a picturesque sanctuary for waterfowl, bald eagles, and countless other species, including the endangered Delmarva fox squirrel. One-third of all Maryland's tidal wetlands can be found here at the refuge, easily making it one of the most notable ecological sites in the state. But from a purely aesthetic level, the refuge is one of the most serene and beautiful places on the Eastern Shore. And we caught up with Visitor Services Manager Ray Patero at the observation platform along the Wildlife Drive. We talked about the refuge's past, its present, and its future, but we started with the refuge's link to Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, to give people a really brief history of the Fish and Wildlife Service, you go all the way back to 1903, back to the days of when Teddy Roosevelt was the president of this country, and he was an avid outdoorsman, and he understood that a lot of the wildlife was being overhunted. And the first place he realized was Pelican Island off the eastern coast of Florida. And it was a little five-acre island where a lot of the birds would nest. They were hunting those for their feathers. He created that refuge. Before his time expired as the president, he had created some 50 natural areas. Another thing that was happening is the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl era, and a lot of wetlands were being drained for agriculture. And some people were doing studies and started to figure out migratory patterns of waterfowl was the main focus back then. This was a heavily used area by waterfowl. So in 1933, Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge was established for the use of a resting and feeding area for waterfowl. At that time, we got 8,000 acres. This used to be part of what was called the Delmarva Fur Farm, and this is where they were trapping and harvesting muskrats for the fur trade. We got a piece of property from the Delmarva Fur Farm, the 8,000 acres, and since 1933, we've been adding whenever it becomes available to the refuge, which brings us up to 28,000 acres.
You guys do a good bit to keep the wild animals almost away from the visitors who come here and keep them purely wild, whereas in some national parks, they allow some sort of, you know, interaction. Talk about the differences in that.
To me, the difference is national parks, I always consider them America's playground. When national parks were established, it was areas that people used to like to go to and recreate. They drew people, whether it was some natural feature like the Grand Canyon or a wild river that people would like to canoe or kayak. So it always had been about people. National Wildlife Refuges, the reason they were established was because we needed to set aside pieces of land either for the habitat itself or for the wildlife that was using those particular pieces of land. It's not that you cannot come out to a National Wildlife Refuge and enjoy it or recreate. It's that the recreational activities have to be compatible to the mission of that refuge. So this refuge was a resting area, resting and feeding area for waterfowl. When we established this, our purpose was to provide habitat for waterfowl. If the waterfowl are in the area, we don't want people going into those areas and disturbing the waterfowl because every time they have to move, they're just expending energy and it's unnecessary. So what we do is we look at areas where people can recreate and we make sure it's compatible with the mission of the refuge. So yes, you can come out here and you can hunt. We have endangered species. Obviously, we're not going to have squirrel hunting because we have an endangered squirrel and we don't want people to get confused. But you can come out here and you can turkey hunt. You can waterfowl hunt. You can also deer hunt. And we open certain areas of the refuge that are closed to the general public for hunting. And we also consider hunting not only a recreational activity, but it also is a management tool. So by hunting, you're helping us keep the deer population in check. And if we didn't keep the deer population in check, they would move out onto private land and start eating the farmers' crops. And they would eat a lot of the crops that we're growing for waterfowl. So it's a recreational activity and it's a management tool as well. Wildlife observation, as long as you're not harassing wildlife, it's not a bad thing for somebody to come out here and look through a scope and get to see an osprey out in open water and hunt, or to see one of these endangered Delmarva Peninsula fox squirrels. We don't have a lot of fishing. It's not that you cannot come out here and fish, but the fishing is not that good on the refuge. It's very shallow water. So we look at activities that the people want to do. We try to provide those activities, but we make sure that they're adaptable, compatible type activities to what the mission of the system and the refuge in particular is.
So much has been said this summer about the heat wave and the drought of crops, you know, and you mentioned the farmers. You know, I remember talking a few months ago when the grade report came out for the state of the coastal bays and the Chesapeake Bay. You know, I remember speaking with somebody from the Maryland Coastal Bays, and he was telling me that nutrient levels are killing off some of the seagrasses. You know, what's happening here at the refuge? Are you seeing that same thing?
Yeah, whatever affects the bay affects this refuge. You've heard the saying about how somebody always lives downstream. It's the same in the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay basically feeds, it's mainly the Little Blackwater River and the Blackwater River. So the Chesapeake Bay feeds these areas. So if you see high nitrogen loads or high fertilizers being used in the bay, it'll make its way onto the refuge. It's the same with drought. The only difference is we're not in this to make money. This is not about growing corn that can be harvested, that can be sold. It's about growing corn for wildlife. So when any other farmer in the area has a drought and his corn is not as healthy as it usually is, we see the same thing here. The only difference is it's not our pocketbook that's affected. It's more the wildlife that ends up getting affected.
Well, tell me a little bit about how that's affecting all the species of animals that live here. How are they adapting to it?
Well, what happens is if you get like an algae bloom or if you get oxygen levels that are too high, animals will move out of those areas. You'll either see a die-off or you'll see animals moving out of the area. So if we would usually have a lot of blue crabs in this area, or we'd have a lot of striped bass in the area, and then you start to see really high or really low oxygen levels, or if you start to see algae blooms, a lot of these animals are just going to move to other areas. So without us doing a lot of monitoring, it's kind of let nature take its course. Without seeing a lot of heavy monitoring or having any kind of commercial value for us on the refuge, we don't see it directly. The indirect effect is going to be a lot of the birds or other animals that feed on these won't have that food source available, and they may move to other areas.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm your host, Brian Russo. We're speaking with Ray Patera of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're standing on the new observation deck at Blackwater National Refuge. I've brought my family here a few times, and we've seen certainly the bald eagles and just the many, you know, different species of birds. I had read somewhere that this is one of the best areas if you want to see a bald eagle.
As most people know, back in the 60s and 70s, the bald eagle populations had declined dramatically, and in this area there were only about 20 pairs of bald eagles around. Now during peak season you'll see upwards of 180 bald eagles in the area, and we have about 35 active nests right around the refuge, and just in Dorchester County alone I think we're up to somewhere around 75 bald eagle nests. So it is a great area. We always tell people that there are more bald eagles in on the refuge or in this area anywhere north of Florida and east of the Mississippi River. So it's a great place to come out and see bald eagles. And then we're also along the Atlantic Flyway. It's a migratory route. So there's birds moving through here year-round. And oftentimes in the fall and in the spring is when you'll hit those peak migrations. But if you come out here in the winter as well, you'll start to see a lot of waterfowl, a lot of geese, both snow geese, Canada geese, and then you'll see things. The early ones passing through are your teal. Then you'll start to see things like pintail and black ducks and mallards and gadwall, all the other birds that come through here and stop and refuel and rest.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the endangered Delmarva squirrel. If this, you know, refuge wasn't here protecting it, perhaps that species would cease to exist. But tell me about what the outlook for the future is for the Delmarva squirrel.
The Delmarva Peninsula fox squirrel gets its name Delmarva because of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. And it was originally in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. And there's also talk that it was in small sections of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. It's a fox squirrel, but it's much larger than what people traditionally think of your standard fox squirrel. It's got a bushy tail. It's usually kind of a whitish-gray color, and it prefers to move on the ground. It doesn't jump from tree to tree. It moves across the ground. It'll go up a tree, climb back down, move across the ground. It forages on the ground as well. That squirrel, due to habitat destruction and development, its population had declined dramatically, and Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge was the only place where that squirrel still existed. We were able to keep it from the brink of extinction, get the population coming up again, and then we were able to relocate that squirrel to other sites along the Delmarva. Not all of them were a success story, but there's 11 different sites where people can now go and see Delmarva Peninsula fox squirrels. And the idea behind that is if you've only got a few squirrels, you get the population stable, but if you don't move them to other areas, if there's any kind of an outbreak or catastrophic event, such as a wildfire that would wipe through this whole refuge or some sort of disease, you basically wipe out the whole population. So ideally in wildlife recovery is you want to get that population back up to a sustainable number and then start relocating them back into their historic range. So it's been a great success story. A lot of people go down to Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge because it's a better opportunity to see that squirrel. But what they don't realize is that squirrel came from initially the population at Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge.
You know, we mentioned earlier, we were talking about the nutrients that are kind of getting to the marsh grasses. What are some of the other big effects that scientists are finding that are, you know, examples of climate change?
I think the problem with climate change is it's so subtle that people sometimes don't even notice it. I think if you think about last winter, it wasn't very cold. If you think about this summer, it was extremely hot and it was extremely dry. Weather patterns around the country and around the world are changing. The climate itself is changing. Some of the things you see is birds aren't migrating as far south or as far north as they used to because they don't have to. They can find food sources in various places. A lot of plant species are moving further north or further south than they used to just because of the change in the climate zones. So you're seeing migratory patterns disrupted. Out in the water, you're starting to see changes in temperature. So where there used to be fish, there are no longer fish, or fish are moving into areas where they used to not occupy. So a lot of these different niches are being occupied by species that at one time were not there. And as this happens, you start to see competition. If you've got a particular bird that feeds on one plant, and all of a sudden there's other birds coming through that also feed on that plant, there's competition for that particular plant. Or if you have an animal that migrates through based on when a particular insect hatches out, and the insect's hatching out earlier now because of climate change, because of the weather not being as cold or as hot as it used to be, all of a sudden these other animals, like these birds, they have to change their migratory patterns, or the main food source is not available when they're coming through. The other thing we see here on the refuge with climate change is you're starting to see a lot more salt in the water itself. We call it brackish water, where it's got some salinity content, but it's not full salt water, and that's based on parts per thousand or parts per million when somebody does a study. A lot of this salt water is actually getting into the groundwater table, and what used to be fresh water is now having this salt inundate it, and you're seeing die-off in the trees. You're also seeing a change in sea levels themselves, and just a slight change in sea level brings the water further into the marshes. And you're starting to see a lot of these marshes sinking, and with this salt water inundate in these areas, you're starting to see some die-off of the marshes themselves. So it's subtle changes, but if you're around long enough, you'll start to see these things happening.
Patera took us on a bit of a hike around the refuge to show us how sometimes even places the refuge sets aside for public use can often become off-limits if some of the wild animals claim it as their own.
When you start talking about uses on refuges, I talked about they have to be appropriate and they have to be compatible. This trail is very interesting because this trail has been here for years. Then all of a sudden a pair of bald eagles decided to nest right inside this trail. It's wildlife first. That's the mission of refuges. So we had to close the trail to the public so that we didn't create disturbance for the eagles while they were nesting. Then we would open it up after the young had fledged or left the nest.
Right.
Not long after that, great blue herons decided to start nesting here on the trail. So then when we had used to open it right after the eagles had left, the great blue herons were still nesting, so we had to keep the trail closed for a longer period of time. So now this trail closes in late fall and doesn't reopen until late summer because of eagles and herons that nest along the trail.
So essentially, this trail has become kind of a hot spot. It's quite the nesting destination of sorts.
Apparently it is a nesting destination. I mean, it's right next to the open water, so if I'm a bald eagle, this would be the perfect place. It's got very tall trees, easy access to the water, and that's where I'm going to get my food. So if I'm an eagle, yeah, this is wonderful.
Yeah.
And then as far as the herons go, They usually nest high up in the trees, up in the canopy, the upper parts. Mm-hmm. There's good clusters of trees here. They're colonial nesters. They all nest together in an area. So this just happens to be one of their favorite places.
So once you find that birds have taken a spot in the refuge, you know, how much do you do to just kind of leave them alone? I guess that interaction between, you know, the Park and Wildlife Service and the wild animals. I know you guys try and keep your distance. How hard is that to do?
It's not that hard, but the hardest part is probably trying to get the public to understand what is our main mission. We are here because of wildlife. We're here to protect fish, wildlife, plants, their habitat, and it's for the continuing benefit of the American people. So our purpose is protect the wildlife. If there becomes a conflict between people and wildlife, it's wildlife first. Mm-hmm. And that's what we'll continue to do.
To learn more about the Blackwater National Refuge, click to our website, wamucoast.org. Coming up next, we head to the little village of Whitehaven.
The Whitehaven Ferry is probably the reason why the village of Whitehaven is here, although the ferry was here much, much earlier.
And then we finish our trip on the beach as we revisit our chat with the organizer of one of the biggest events ever to come to the Eastern Shore, the Dew Tour.
It's not been done in action sports in this way, so you're going to see these sports from a different perspective than you ever have, and also just be able to see the whole scope and feel of the event, which is massive. So we're excited about, you know, both the competition aspect of this and then just the overall great beauty shots we'll get.
Do you know of an interesting town on the coast that's maybe off the beaten path, but full of history and personality? Well, we'd like to know about it, and then we'd like to come visit and tell your town's story. So send us an email to coastal@wamu.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm Brian Russo, and we'll be right back.